Want to make a quick announcement. Someone has asked me about administration officials, and we're so glad that Julie could be here. She actually, it was so interesting. When I called her, she answered her own phone. And I thought, that's really unique in these days. Now I know maybe why. But she was so gracious in her willingness to join us. And we did invite, as many of you know, Secretary Rollins, who unfortunately couldn't accept, and also EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, who was ironically heading out today so he can do an event tomorrow at a farm. So we were unable to have Administrator Zeldin here, but we're very glad to have Venus Welch White. Venus, if you want to stand for a second. She's the acting... She's the acting director of the Office of Agricultural and Rural Affairs, and so if you have any EPA questions, I'm sure she's ready and able to answer any of them. Thank you, Venus. Now let's welcome our panel on up to the stage, and we'll get started. So we're in the home stretch with this final panel, and I'm delighted you're all hanging in here. It's been a long day of discussions, and that just shows the interest, I guess, in some of these different policy topics. As we get started here, I'm really delighted to welcome Kip Eidenberg with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, Matt Micah with American Hort, Kelly Adesina with Kraft Heinz, and Randy Russell with the Russell Group. Thank you all for joining us here today as we wrap up. And before we get started with our discussion, our theme has been navigating taxes, trade, and technology, but we know there's some other topics that may be on your mind too. So we wanted to do two final Slido questions. The first one is just going to create a word cloud up on the screen, but we wanted to have you name off one of the biggest threats to American agriculture in 2025 and beyond. So take out your mobile device and give us some answers in one word of what the biggest threat is. A little prompt for our panel here. Labor's up first. Yep. Tariff seems to be taking center stage for now. Now we've got a little bit of everything here. Pseudoscience, animal disease, climate change, MAHA, and misinformation. Lots of good things that are on people's minds. They're not so good, I guess. It's the biggest threat. Well, let's look at this. Let's turn the table a little bit and talk about what do you see as the biggest opportunity for U.S. agriculture in 2025 and beyond? Big focus on innovation. Kip, we got all sorts of stuff in your wheelhouse here. Tariffs and innovation. Biotech, deregulation, a lot of excitement around that. 45Z came up, so Mitchora must have been making some impact on folks. Clean fuels. Farm bill. Well, great. Well, this gives you kind of a cross-section of everything, and I'm sure Chuck's taken some photos here so we can capture what we recorded from all of you. Thank you for voting. And as we start our discussion today, again, all these different topics that are coming up on people's minds, I thought it'd be good to have Randy, you kick us off with just a little scene setting. We talked earlier on the tax panel about some of the things that are going to be difficult to get accomplished in the 119th Congress and Trump 2.0, but set the stage for us politically and what we're dealing with right now, if you would, Randy.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Sarah, and welcome, everybody. Good to be with you. First of all, let me just say, Sarah, I really appreciate this day. AgriPulse does a great job, and thank you for the service that you all do for all of us to keep us informed each and every day. I say I spend more time listening to Jeff Nally than I do my wife every day, listening to Daybreak and Drive Time and all your open mic sessions. So thanks for all that you do. Maybe I could just start.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you.
So maybe I could just start before turning it over to Kelly and Kip and Matt, is just kind of set the stage politically. And if you go back to the night of November 5th and Donald Trump's elected president, you look and he gets 312 electoral votes. And when you look at the map, he won the popular vote by 2.3 million votes, which very few people were predicting. But when you kind of peel it back and you look at the constituency that we all care about, which is the rural vote, it's really interesting. If you look at a map, Trump won 31 states. And of those 31 states, 16 of them, agriculture is the number one industry in that state. Another 12, agriculture is in the top five of the importance in that state. So together, 28 of the 31 states that Trump won, agriculture is either number one in that state or in the top five in terms of the economic driver. You also peel it back and you look at the number of counties. Those counties that are deemed to be primarily rural, Trump won over 90% of the rural counties. So a significant pickup. You look at him in 2016, he got 57% of the rural vote. In 2020, he got 63% of the rural vote. And in 2024, he got over 70% of the rural vote. So clearly, the rural constituencies are strongly supported President Trump. So I think that is just kind of leveling kind of where we find ourselves. Obviously, the Republicans control the Senate by three votes. They control the House by two. Actually, it's four if you add in J.D. Vance. And just two other things I'd point out real quickly, Sarah. You know, we finish one election, and then we immediately start focusing on the next election. And if you look in traditionally, going back the last 100 years, the party that's in power, the White House, the first midterm election in the Senate, they lose four seats. And in the House, it's 28 seats. Now, that is traditionally, but we're certainly not in conventional or traditional times. And if you look at the Senate, Republicans have 20 seats to defend in 2026, and Democrats only have 13. So clearly, the field is tilted in the direction of Democrats. Democrats, though, have got some challenges in that they now have open seats in New Hampshire, in Michigan, and Minnesota because of retiring members. So those are going to be competitive seats. And for Republicans, I think the Tillis seat in North Carolina, as well as probably the Collins seat in Maine, will be very competitive. In the House, we'll just have to see how all this policy plays out. But traditionally, 28 seats in the House flip against the party in the White House. So that's a little level setting as we get into discussion.
Thanks, Randy. Matt, let's turn it over to you. Labor picked up here early as a topic, and I know it's critically important, not only to everybody in the room, especially to your organization. Tell us about the current state of play and what seems to be a perennial problem for anyone working in agriculture and in, with horticultural products as well.
Thanks, Sarah. Appreciate it. I think anybody who's watched the House and Senate Ag Committees last couple of weeks, the last month, every issue that comes up is labor. I mean, 60 to 75% of the questions from the senators and reps is around labor. It's around H-2A, it's around H-2B, and the A-ware. One thing now that we actually have all the secretaries in, now that Secretary Dreamer is in, for folks that don't know, she was part of 12 members, six Republicans, six Democrats, last Congress to put together an ag working group that G.T. Thompson put together with David Scott, the ranking member. A lot of that stuff can be done on day one, working with the Secretary of Agriculture, Rollins, and DHS and others, but it wouldn't be permanent. So due to that, G.T. Thompson a couple weeks ago announced he is putting a bill together with those 15 recommendations from the bipartisan group that came together. So talking with staff, they're going to be moving that forward. I know IFPA is here, and they're one of the sponsors. They had someone testify a couple weeks ago in the House Ag Committee, and this gentleman spoke from California, and he said, look, I got into H-2A because I didn't have enough workers, but now it's going to price me out. It's $24 an hour for H-2A for the average across the U.S. when you add in housing, transportation, and everything with it. So H-2A and H-2B and all the programs related to agriculture are good, but they need to be reformed. We are pricing ourselves out of it, and talking to my members and talking with all the members of the AWC, the Ag Working Group on labor, the issue that comes up is labor. It's not farm bill. It's not other things, but it's labor, because without the labor and the cost going up, your inputs are more than your outputs. And it's really a concern for agriculture, which is why we're telling people we haven't fixed this since 1986. We need to do it now. And we have some folks in place that we think can do it. But we got to put some of our members of Congress and senators on notice that they need to fix it, or we're going to have a real problem in rural America and agriculture and agribusiness.
Thanks, Matt. Kelly, over to you. Kraft Heinz, one of the biggest food beverage companies globally. There are probably a lot of words that came up here as threats or things that are in your wheelhouse right now. How are you navigating all the changes for your company, trying to figure out how to stay ahead of some of these things that are popping up, it seems like, by the minute some days?
Yeah, so I will say that I am employed. I am booked and busy, is what I would say. But before I begin my remarks, I want to thank you, Sarah, and AgriPulse for having me here today. There are some great people in the room, so I'm glad to be amongst, you know, a number of experts when it comes to food and ag issues. As it pertains to all the things that we're navigating, I actually tried to sit down and write out a list of the different things that are impacting the industry. And as you can imagine, the list was long. Anything from tariffs, you know, we are a global company. We are in over 40 countries. You know, we manufacture most of the foods here that we produce in America, but we do source ingredients from all over the world. We definitely are friends with our Canadian, you know, neighbors and, you know, Mexican neighbors as well. And so there's a significant impact that we would feel should these tariffs go into place. We also think about what's happening with steel and aluminum. You know, the Capri Sun that all of you love, or maybe most of you love, or your children love, includes aluminum. And that 25% tariff is real. You know, taking that aside, you know, there's a lot of things that are happening around ingredients, not only on a federal level, but also on a state level. And quite honestly, that's where we're seeing a lot of the activity. It's just, you know, trying to figure out what the states are doing. And it's hard to keep up. Last week, West Virginia passed a bill banning, you know, the use of FD&C colors, food, drug, and cosmetic colors in foods, and also banning BHA. And so that took place probably within 2 weeks. Now, in D.C., nothing passes that quickly, right? And so just imagine the speed that we have to, you know, use or to implement to keep up with all that activity, and that's just one state. I think about, you know, what's happening from, you know, SNAP and all the things that are going on there with possible restrictions, thinking about reconciliation. So there's just so much happening right now for food and beverage companies. And I think also, you know, one of the things that people don't always consider when they think about Kraft Heinz is that we do have an agricultural, you know, footprint as well. We harvest the most tomatoes in the country. As you can imagine, our ketchup is beloved. And so as one of my former coworkers would say, you know, we are big ketchup. And so we have a lot of tomatoes that we're harvesting in California. We also harvest our cucumbers, you know, in Ohio, and our potatoes in Idaho. And so there's a lot that we have going on. And so just trying to balance all these different things and also making sure that we keep consumers' thoughts, you know, and inputs at the forefront has also been complicated, right? It's not lost upon us that there's a conversation around food prices, and we think about what happens with ingredient bans and how do we balance that with trying to come up with alternative ingredients for different foods is quite a bit. And the last thing I would say is, you know, overall, we also have to keep in mind the palates, right? So consumers say that they want certain things, and we try to be responsive to that. And quite honestly, we've changed over about 1,000 of our recipes in the last 5 years. But it takes time for the palate to catch up to that. And that was not a pun. But it takes time to catch up to, you know, to that stuff, right? Like, we need to make sure that as we make changes to our products that the consumer will want to still buy it. We reduced, you know, sugar by 55 million pounds. And one of our, you know, main products, we reduced sugar quite significantly, but people weren't purchasing it. And so we do have to balance all these different things. And so when you think about the food and beverage company, you know, like I said earlier, we are booked and busy because there's a lot going on right now.
Wow, sounds like it. So, and as a reminder for everyone, please submit your questions via Slido if you have some for our distinguished panel here, and because I'll keep asking questions if you don't. Kip, let's talk about AEM a little bit. You represent over 1,000 companies with ag and construction equipment. They've some of them haven't been having stellar years here lately as the farm economy has turned down a bit. Talk to us just a little bit about the supply chain in manufacturing for your members and how it's being impacted by some of the changes that we're seeing in this new administration and the tariffs.
Right, so it's the T word. It's what's keeping us up at night. It is daunting to follow Big Ketchup, but I will do my best. So, look, obviously, our member companies are extremely concerned about the current trade environment and the tariffs. In fact, we had a meeting this morning with about 40 of our CEOs. And, you know, 21 to 23 were strong years for our industry. 24, we ended it with lower sales year over year. And 25 is currently not looking great. And to the extent that we are a reflection of the broader ag economy, and I think we are in many ways, you know, equipment manufacturers, particularly in the ag side, adjusting labor and capital investments down, drawing down production in response to the tariffs. And, you know, we know from having crunched the numbers that we expect industrial production of farm equipment to go down somewhere between 2.3 and 3.6% this year, which is quite significant. We know from recent numbers, and we'll have a study come out to this effect here in a couple of weeks, that if things don't change, we're looking at a 2.7 to 3% reduction in labor force. That's about 12,000 direct jobs, 64,000 indirect jobs. So none of this obviously is good news for the industry. And you know, I'm not exaggerating when I say that the tariffs, they are a clear and present danger to our industry, and things will continue to get worse if we don't do something about them. You mentioned supply chains. I'll give you another number. The president is fond of talking about trade deficits and trade surpluses. We have a trade surplus with Canada. We send about $10 billion worth of equipment, parts and components north every year. We only import about 2.7. Now, of course, the Canadians, as everyone here knows, they're putting in place retaliatory tariffs. Now, that's bad news for Canadian farmers as well. So all in all, and I wish I had better news on the T word, there's some signs of optimism, obviously, when it comes to other policy priorities of the administration, which, you know, maybe we can dig into, tax reform, permitting reform, energy exploration, perhaps a farm bill, looking at you, Randy. So obviously there's some policy wins on the horizon, but right now, you know, this is what's keeping us up at night, and obviously the concern is shared by our end users. We hear almost daily from you know, from farmers and ranchers that this is you know, an equal concern of theirs. We were out in Denver together, Sarah, Commodity Classic. I mean, I think that was the one thing that everyone kept talking about. So, you know, the outlook on that end for the industry for 25 is not great. But again, we're hoping that we can get some other policy wins here that can help offset some of that. And I don't know if this is a good transition or not, but obviously the farm bill, you know, for us is front and center when it comes to that, as well as addressing some of these tax provisions that are expiring.
So just to follow up on that then, talk about whether you think or what you'd like to see in a farm bill that would be most helpful to your industry.
Well, from our perspective, and I'll let the rest of the panel here weigh in on what they see, for us, first and foremost, we want to see a farm bill, period, because while you know extensions can be necessary, and sometimes if you're extending something that is halfway decent, okay, then you continue to get halfway decent, but what you lose is the policy innovation, and it's the opportunities missed to continue to innovate on the policy side that is the biggest for us problem with the farm bill. I mean, there's opportunities here for USDA, for the administration to really help incentivize things like the adoption of precision agriculture technologies. For our industry, obviously, that's a key priority, and for farmers and ranchers as well, making sure that they have access to the tools and the solutions that they need to grow more using less. That has never been more important. So that would be one priority that stands out to us is making sure that we don't miss the opportunity to innovate. And for equipment manufacturers, it starts and ends with precision agriculture.
So I'll ask you all the obvious question a little later, but let's just go down the row here and talk about, in a farm bill, what would be your organization's priorities, Matt?
Sure. Juan, I know there's some staff here, so be careful what we say. For us, it's research and development. For everyone that knows, you know, working with the land grants, working with the HBCUs, the 1890s, I mean, everything starts in a nursery and greenhouse in our industry. So for us at American Hort, we represent nurseries, greenhouses, garden centers, landscapers, and allied members. So everything starts and has to be grown. I don't know if anybody's looked at this, but we've taken some of the numbers. Since 2019, since we passed the last farm bill in 2018, 51% of the House and Senate have not voted on a farm bill. So for you and your organizations and your companies and your trades, if you're not up on the Hill talking to your members of Congress and staff and senators, we're losing out because somebody else is. So one, make sure they're coming into town, and two, invite them out to your farms and your facilities. So 535, over 51%, have not voted on a farm bill. And of the new members coming in, a lot of them don't know. I mean, we all know the numbers. Less than 2% of the American public is involved in farming. And we all know why a farm bill is important. But most staff, most members, most senators do not. So again, I'll say it again. If we're not telling the story, somebody else is. So get in there, get on your issues. Another big one for us, and we've been working with both the House and Senate Ag Committee, is getting into crop insurance and disaster relief for nurseries and greenhouses. We just have a different industry. I mean, a lot of our commodities and for our growers takes 8 to 10 years, like Christmas trees. It just takes a long time. And if something happens as it's growing, it's really hard to figure out what that cost is.
Kelly?
In an ideal world, which I don't know if we have one right now, but in an ideal world, I know that at one point in time we were very concerned about Prop 12, Massachusetts Question 3. Again, as you can imagine, you know, for us as a food and beverage company trying to source, bellies that, you know, are compliant with those two laws have been, we've managed it. We were, you know, early adopters, and so we were able to work with suppliers that could comply with those laws. But, you know, one of the things that we always are concerned about is increased state activity. And so, you know, if other states kind of come on board and say, well, instead of 24 square feet, we think that, you know, they should be housed in an enclosure of 28 square feet, then that would mean that we would need to, you know, source a new supplier or go back to the supplier and have them increase their gestation area for their pork bellies. And so just trying to make sure that we can keep what we have is really important. At one point in time, there was some language, I believe, on the House side to address this issue. But, I mean, it's been so long ago that we've talked about the farm bill that I can't even keep up at this point to see if it's still in there. But that is something that we would like to see in the bill if it does, you know, move through.
So, Kelly, you and I were on a panel, was it 2 years ago now in Savannah, when we were talking about whether we were going to get a farm bill that year. We have yet to have anyone here today tell us that they're optimistic about 2025 for passage. Randy, is there any reason for optimism for farm bill passage this year?
Sarah, there is always room for optimism. Come on, there's always room. Look, I think there's three or four things that need to get done. First and foremost, we need to update our reference prices and our marketing loans. They have gotten outdated. Kip's talking about what's happening on the farm equipment side. You talk to rural lenders, whether it's a farm credit system or independent bankers, they're telling us all the same thing, that these have gotten outdated and we need to address those, similar to Chairman Thompson had in his bill that was reported from committee or some derivation of it. I'd say that's number one. Number two, full disclosure, we work on this. We need to significantly increase funding for the market access program and foreign market development. If I was going to put a chart up and leave you with one chart, it would be the ag export chart. And that's the chart that shows that in 2012, we were running an agricultural trade surplus of $37 billion. And the USDA is forecasting this year a trade deficit of nearly $50 billion. In a matter of 12 years, folks, we have gone from a trade surplus of $37 billion to a trade deficit of $50 billion. Now, that's stunning to me. And it's something that needs to be addressed. And we've got to be very aggressive on getting new trade agreements. Third, and this is something that many of us talk about, but frankly, we have failed on it, and that's investment in agricultural research. I think far too many times that's the top of everybody's B list, and we never get to the B list. And it's time that we really reinvest. If we're going to turn around these trade numbers, if we're going to embrace the innovation that Kip talked about, we've got to have our seed corn well funded, and that is the basic ag research we need to support. And finally, we are seeing, Kelly alluded to this, a plethora of state laws and referendums that are going into place, which are having a significant impact in our ability, whether it's on the livestock side or the crop protection side, for us to do business in interstate commerce. And that is something that it is high time that we step up and support the preemption, which is behind much of what FDA does, what USDA does through its meat inspection and through many of the other laws that have very strong federal preemption provisions, but the states are overriding it in its action, and it's impacting everybody in this room and our industry. So I'd say those are the four things.
Sarah, can I add something to that too as well? First, it's always great to be on a panel with Randy because he always has a great, you know, way to kind of just summarize these things. One thing I would say, since we have a captive audience, is that, you know, when we think about the conversations that are taking place right now, most of them are around tariffs or maybe reconciliation. We're not hearing as much conversation around the Farm Bill. And I think that the people in this room are able to raise the level of conversation on the Hill. As Matt mentioned earlier, when you think about the members of Congress that have actually voted on a Farm Bill before, we're running at a deficit. And we're also thinking about the staffers, of course, that support the folks that, you know, write those Farm Bills. I was a former staffer, you know, wrote the 2018 Farm Bill. I'm not there anymore, right? And so there's so many of us as well that have transitioned to different jobs. And so we really want to make sure that we are doing our part in making sure that, you know, we don't allow this conversation to go too silent, because I don't really hear it as, you know, discussed as much as I think we should be discussing it. I don't want us to get too comfortable with the one-year extensions, and now we've had two. So just make sure that we can do our part in raising the level of dialogue there.
Good point, Kip.
Yeah, no, and I echo what Randy said. Obviously, anything that's good for farmers and ranchers in rural America is generally good for the equipment manufacturing industry. I think it's important that we don't forget about biofuels, too, whether in the context of the Farm Bill or just broadly as a priority. The president has been very clear about, you know, making us energy independent. He sees this as key to our national security. Biofuels has to be part of that mix. And I'm a little worried when you know, kind of similar to what you said about the Farm Bill, you just don't hear about it enough anymore. It's all tariffs, all taxes, all the time. That's important, but we got to keep the focus on biofuels too.
Yeah, good point. We did have some good discussions earlier about some of the tax incentives, the clean fuels incentives, and what's likely to happen on that front. So there are so many different things. You ever feel like you're just playing like a whack-a-mole? You just hit one down and the next one pops up. It seems like that to some of the folks that I talked to today. And one of the other topics that came up several times was the Make America Healthy Again movement. Obviously, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is leading that. He's got the president's ear on even the French fries are going to be healthier because we're going to cook them in beef tallow now. And so some questions have come in on this vein. First of all, asking about anti-seed oils, that sentiment that you're seeing. I know I walked in a grocery store not too long ago, and this big banner across a bunch of the products saying, our products contain no seed oils. And, you know, it's a thing, right, for especially some of the MAHA moms. Kelly, are you seeing any growing sentiment on this? It's worrisome that you may have to change your ingredient mix. And then secondly, and anyone can jump in here on MAHA, but maybe start with you on the anti-seed oil question, and then we'll go to overall food inflation.
Yeah, so there's been a lot when it comes to the MAHA movement. You know, I mentioned earlier about the state activity around ingredient bans, but we also, you know, hear some of that stuff on the federal level. You know, there's a MAHA caucus in the Senate and in the House, and, you know, there's legislation on things like grass, generally recognized as safe. And then we've also, if you walk around town, you know Sarah, you mentioned the banner that you saw, but I remember walking not too far from the Hill, and there was a sign that said, you know, no seed oils used in our foods, right? And it was a restaurant. So we are seeing a lot, and we're just trying to figure out how to navigate the space, quite honestly. From a Kraft Heinz perspective, our position has always been that we are willing to work with, you know, every administration so that we can be partners and discuss, you know, the impacts that it would have on the business. I think right now our main focus is trying to make sure people understand, like, the ecosystem, you know, and how it all works together, you know, how we source, you know, the seed oils from farmers. You know, we got to get the seed, so that comes first, and then, you know, how we use it in our foods and why we use it. I think sometimes that might be missed as well, the purpose of some of the things that we actually use in our foods, and then also the impact that it could have on the overall, you know, taste and also cost, and then I mentioned earlier that the palate. So there's a lot of education. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of misinformation out there as well, and sometimes the voices on one side of the issue can be a little bit louder than others, and so we're trying to figure out how best to navigate this, but it definitely is a lot that falls under that MAHA banner.
Are there also opportunities as well for the ag community to engage and perhaps elevate products? Like, I know Senator Marshall is leading the Senate MAHA caucus. He's all excited. You know, we're going to bring whole milk back into schools. And I talked to him a couple of weeks ago and gave me kind of the lowdown of all the wonderful things that MAHA is going to do. So are there also opportunities for segments that maybe felt that they were maybe pushed down in the ranking of favorable food products in the past?
Well, Sarah, I would just jump in and say, you know, I do think as an industry collectively, agriculture and food broadly defined, we would be making a mistake if we did not at least admit we have a health problem in this country. 70% of Americans are obese or overweight. 50% of Americans have hypertension or high blood pressure. 15% of American adults have type 2 diabetes. More stunning to me, and I have 6 kids, 37% of kids today are pre-diabetic. So I think we do have to admit we have a health problem in this country. Now, that's the description of the problem. Laying it at the doorstep of production agriculture in the food industry, I think is ridiculous. And what do I mean by that? It took us decades to develop the health problems that we have in this country, and the solutions are multifaceted. You know, when I was in school, people like Ted and I, because we're about the same age here, you know, that goes back decades ago, we actually had physical ed all 4 years of high school. Our society has gotten very sedentary. We don't exercise as a nation like we used to. We have emotional issues. We have high rates of depression in this country. We have lots of issues that are feeding into the health problem, and it's showing up in the costs of our health programs. Look at the Medicare. Medicare is going to cost over $1 trillion. The Medicare trust fund is going to go belly up in 11 years. Now, that's driven by the cost of health or the ill health of America. I would also say our kids' generation is going to be the first one that is going to have a lower life expectancy than ours. So I'm just suggesting, I think we have to admit as an industry we have a health problem, and I think what we need to do is engage. and where we have things like crop protection tools that are absolutely critically important for us to produce crops and food around this country and do it in an economical way, do it in a safe way, I think we need to draw the line there. We have the food industry where it has become the focus now of this whole MAHA movement, and I think it just is a very simplistic solution to a very complex problem, and I think we've got to do a better job of communicating this more holistically so that we don't end up being the poster child of the MAHA movement.
I'll just add to that, to Randy's point with the tools, we got to make sure that EPA and USDA are working with these folks. That's one reason, I don't know if anybody's talked to Representative David Rouser, he's on the caucus to bring a little bit of sense from agriculture. So when they're talking about getting rid of pesticides and herbicides, we all know how important that is, but most people don't. You say that word to the average American, they're like, oh, ban it. But when you talk about what it gets rid of, especially in my world with flowers and plants and trees, like, we need those. Those are vital. And it takes 10 to 15 years to get some of those. And there's a process and there's like a whole way it goes through, but most Americans don't do that. So if we don't have the help of EPA and USDA talking through this MAHA movement and through the White House, we're going to have some real problems because they're going to take a lot of our tools away that we use that make agriculture and farming in our world just successful.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't pick up on what Randy said about young people sitting around and not doing much, and maybe we can just transition briefly to workforce, because boy, do we have opportunities. But it's
start them at age 12.
Yeah, well, could we? But it's a big problem too, right? And we talked earlier about how, you know, tariffs and taxes are keeping people up at night. But the workforce is the bigger challenge, right? We could create 85,000 jobs tomorrow as an industry if we had enough qualified people willing to work. And much like you cannot pick up and move a third generation manufacturing facility in Northwest Iowa, you can't pick up and move a third generation farm, you know, in Indiana or Ohio, wherever it is, right? And we just do not have, you know, there's a lot of talk about all these great policies and we got to make more things in America and make America healthy again and all that. Well, who's going to do all of that? Because we don't have enough people. You know, most of our member companies are in states or counties that have a negative population growth. So how do we address that going forward, right? And you talked about this, you know, a little bit about the national health crisis. I think we have a work crisis in the sense that we have, there's too many stigmas out there about what it means to have a good, fruitful, rewarding career. And we haven't done a good enough job, you know, our industry, you know, we have a reputation. We're working to address it, right, of manufacturing as a whole being dark, dangerous. It's nothing but if you go to a modern manufacturing facility, you know, much like modern food production and farming is sophisticated, advanced, and so that's another thing that I think if we don't keep pushing that, and unlike what worries me is that unlike, let's say, taxes where, you know, we could get a tax package passed, hopefully, or a farm bill, workforce is sort of a seven-headed hydra. You cut off two heads and five more pop up, right? How do you start addressing this? Because I think the problem is that we got to change our outlook as a society. And that requires more than just policy and legislation, right? It requires just a different mindset. So and I'd be curious to hear too from the rest of you. I'm sure you are facing the same problems. I don't know, Matt?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, labor is our biggest issue, just workforce. I think one thing, we have too many young folks, and you nailed it, Kip, that they want to go at home and be an influencer, you know. You can't do that. I mean, some people can make a living off that, but how do we get people back into agriculture? How do we get them back on the farm or in a facility? How do we make sure our community college, junior colleges, land grants, as I mentioned, 1890s and HBCUs, get the folks out there that want to do it? Because a lot of times there are people, they just don't know where the jobs are at, or how do we get them to move to Idaho or, you know, Southwest Kansas or, you know, Oregon or Washington. As I mentioned earlier, you know, you look at the H-2A and H-2B programs, people are paying $20 to $24 an hour. We know walking onto a farm right now, depending what state, you're paying $12 to $20 just to walk on. I don't think high school and college kids know that. And then we all know what happens when we have to deal with all the thing that the average folks don't want to work there. One thing I'll throw in there I should have mentioned, President Trump uses H-2A on his wineries in Virginia, and he uses H-2B on his golf courses. So we're trying to call these the Trump programs because he has a chance there to fix them and regulate them. And also, it's also a border protection issue. People bring it up all the time. These people are vetted. I know H-2A and H-2B and the H programs aren't going to fix the workforce program, but it's a start. So,
Matt, I am a massive influencer. I have 200 Instagram followers. So, you know, I'm really
three of them are right here.
Yeah.
Facts.
Very good. You know, I just wanted to make a point about what both you and Kip were saying, and that is you can tie some of the ag trade deficit numbers to the fact that if we had a more reliable workforce, we would be producing, harvesting, and picking more produce here in the United States and not south of the border. So there are direct linkages here between policies on labor and other issues that we care about, and then we come up with another program to try to fix the problem. It is labor, labor, labor. When you talk to people in the produce industry, and Matt, I'm sure it's the same with you in your industry, they'll say their number one constraint in growth is access to labor. And until we address that, I think some of the fundamentals in terms of production, it is not someone having a comparative advantage except for the fact that we don't have the labor here that we have made available to our industry.
So we did some deep dive on the workforce issue a year ago, and it seems like there's a lot of people trying several different things, whether it's earlier recruitment, starting in middle school and working more with career guidance officers. But is the industry doing enough collectively to work together, or are we still fairly siloed in our attempts to bring more workforce out and develop it in rural America? Your thoughts, Kip?
I think we're way too siloed. I think that, as I said earlier, I think this is a national crisis. I think we ought to work together. I mean, it's all connected, right? I mean, we farmers don't have enough labor. Well, they're not going to buy enough equipment, and we don't have enough labor. We can't make the equipment that they need, we're not making enough noise about it collectively, because this is the kind of effort that's going to require all of us to lean in together. I'm not here to pitch another coalition, because God knows DC doesn't need one, but it's too fragmented, and I don't think we're doing a good enough job of talking about these jobs that are available and how great of a career you can have, whether it's in food production, farming, manufacturing. So we ought to be working together. I don't have any great ideas right now on how we should do it, other than to say that no, we're not. I know I can point to 10 great industry efforts around this, and all of them are wonderful, but they're all siloed, including ours. And they ought to be working together hand in hand.
One of the things I always thought was interesting is growing up, a lot of people who wanted to start farming would often start at factory jobs and meatpacking, and they had opportunities in rural to save money and then buy that first farm. So there was obviously a historical connection to giving people that leg up in terms of being able to get into agriculture if they so wanted. But now it sounds like what we need is at least more conversations around this topic to bring people together around the opportunities in rural America.
Yeah, we need more parents too. I mean, right now the average in our industry, for every five people that walk through the door and accept a job on the factory floor, after 1 week, only one remains. One usually doesn't show up the second day. A couple of people quit after realizing that they're working the night shift. And, a fourth can't pass a drug test, even if it's sort of recreational drugs, right? So you're left with one person. And when the average equipment manufacturer in the Midwest has, 25 to 50 openings, boy, that's not going to cut it.
Matt?
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I was speaking to a group last week. It was high school and college ag teachers. For folks who grew up in rural America, you know what this is about. You went to school, you had an ag teacher that talked about what was going on. You had 4-H, you had FFA. But those programs are being cut, not just from the federal government, but the state and locals. And the young kids were asking what they could do. I was like, you have to go educate your local elected officials and your senators and your governors and your state reps, because they're the ones that are funding that. So it goes to the point of, if we're not having the conversation here and they're not having it in high school or middle school, then no one's going to want to work in ag.
Oh, I think that's right if we don't start. Did you want to add something? Okay. Kelly, this question, I think, goes in your direction. How do you think through state legislation and ingredient bans that create complexity in formulation and packaging? You did mention some of the state different initiatives, so yeah. Can elaborate on that?
So it's been complicated, quite honestly. I mentioned, of course, the ingredient bans, but I didn't even get into packaging. Packaging, we have issues there with extended producer responsibility, with recycling claims, and, you know, there are states that are just doing their own thing. As you can imagine, for example, California has been an early adopter, really active in this space. And so for us, we are trying to figure out, you know, what are those compliance dates like? So we, you know, try our best to keep a chart of, you know, like which state will be up first and then which one's coming up next. And, you know, we've tried to look to the federal government and say, you know, can we harmonize some of these things? Is it possible, you know, to step in? But the federal government just doesn't act as quickly as the state government does. And so it's just a balance. And we're trying to figure out, you know, what is the usually what ends up happening sometimes in these situations is you go with, like, the, you know, state with the strictest requirements and then try to comply there and hope that that, you know, meets the needs of all the other states. But part of it is we just don't know what will come up. And the instability of it all is very complicated for us, you know, as we try to think about how do we plan, how do we source. You know, another thing when it comes to packaging, there's this movement to, you know, move to more compostable, recyclable materials, but part of the issue there is just there's not enough supply, right? Or, you know, there may be the supply there, but it could impact the, you know, longevity of a particular product. So you think about our ketchup sachets, for example. I might not even ask you all to do this, but I know there are quite a few people who have a couple ketchup packets in their drawers right now, right? And so if we move to compostable materials for that, then that will quickly, you know, shorten the lifespan of that ketchup sachet. And so those are the type of things that we're trying to figure out, like how do we, you know, continue to move in the space where we're, you know, being more environmentally friendly and also complying with the different state laws, but also making sure that we keep the cost of products down. I think right now, the time we are with our economy, there's a lot of, you know, attention around food prices. And we feel that, of course, you know, as a food manufacturer. But we also know that we are one piece of that food ecosystem. And so there's so many different things that we have to take into account as we manufacture these products. And so the short answer, which is not really a short answer, is it's complicated.
Are we going to have our little ketchup packets in cardboard instead of... not much fun. Well, I know that in California, in its own right, could make everything complex for anybody trying to produce food and on either on a farm or in a factory. As we wrap up here, I just wanted to go through each of our panelists and get some responses on your expectations for what the people in this room might see or might not see in this Congress in 2025. I mean, we're kind of wrapped around the wheelhouse on the tax package, budget reconciliation. Do we get to a farm bill, yes or no? What could you see as a timeline for anything to happen on the congressional front for this year? Do you want to start, Kip?
Yep. Can I punt and talk about something somewhat related? I'm
guessing you will anyway.
Well, thank you, Sarah. No, but it's not so much the Congress side, but I really do believe that we will see, if not by the end of the year, then certainly by this time next year, a new USMCA. I think everything that we're hearing, conversations that we're having, is that there's a real intent to open this up ahead of next year's mandatory review and negotiate a new and hopefully improved deal. Which, for our industry, from our industry's perspective, would be good news. Obviously, that certainty of having a new trade agreement, comprehensive agreement for North America, is critical to us. 30% of all the equipment we make here is destined for export. And I think it would add that layer of certainty in a very uncertain world. whether it's the farm bill, the tax package, you know, the war in Ukraine, Taiwan, if we can at least get that deal done, that takes one thing off the table. And while I'm never as optimistic as Randy, I am actually optimistic that we will see significant progress on that starting this year and a deal very shortly in the new year.
And tariffs in the meantime?
Buckle up, tariffs are here to stay until we get that deal done.
Okay, Matt?
I see Randy's going last as a seasoned veteran, so we'll give him time. I'm going to change it and do the typical member of Congress. So I didn't grow up in agriculture on a farm, but I've been working in ag for over 25 years at the state level, on the Hill, and off either for a company or trade. We need to stop arguing among ourselves and get together and get things done. If it's tax policy, if it's trade, if it's tariffs, if it's farm bill, if it's energy, if it's labor. Coming off the Hill and now and working in the lovely coalitions that Kip had mentioned, we argue too much, and we let perfect get in the way of good. And we all know this, and we continue to do it. So until we, a community, get together and figure out what needs to get done, and we know what needs to get done, we're not going to get anywhere because the other side's going to come at us. And for all the folks that are worried about President Trump, everything he's done, he has promised in the last year. So he said what he was going to do. He's out there. And as Randy mentioned, rural America farmers, growers, producers, and everyone voted for this. So we have to help them out to get through it. So that's our job in D.C. But we have to stop fighting, and we got to figure out a way to move forward.
Initially, I was going to ask to phone a friend, but I will go ahead and answer the question. I think that what we can expect is that reconciliation will get done. You know, the Senate called for $1 billion in cuts to the ag bill, whereas the House called for $230 billion. I think it will be a number in between. Thank you.
That was better than Bill Hoagland's answer. That, a couple of comments. First on just tariffs for a second. The tariffs so far that have been announced on Canada and Mexico and China, now the EU, I think are primarily tariffs to get us as a means to an end. But coming April 2nd or sometime thereafter, we're going to get into what I would call the rebalancing of trade deficits with countries. And that could be a little bit more problematic because you start thinking about what the tariffs could be if you start taking into account tariffs, non-tariff trade barriers, and VAT taxes, as an example. And these tariffs on some countries could be substantial. So I think that's – I know there's a lot of focus right now on the immediate tariffs, but I think the ones that are looking more at the rebalancing of our trade deficit – and by the way, we're running a we are running a trillion-dollar trade deficit. We have a $290 billion trade deficit with China, a $230 billion trade deficit with Europe. We have a $130 billion trade deficit with Mexico and $80 billion with Canada. I'm talking about overall, Kip. I'm not talking about – and so we clearly have a trade deficit problem, and that has to be addressed. On the farm bill and reconciliation, we will get a reconciliation bill because there's too much of the president's agenda and the Republican-controlled Congress's agenda that is riding on it. I think it will include – some derivation of the 2017 JCTA tax provisions. It's not. I don't think it'll be 10 years. Probably something shorter, 6, 7, 8 years, because of scoring issues. I think there'll be significant investments in the border and in defense spending that will be included in that package. There'll also be reductions, and as Kelly said, it'll be somewhere between. And if I had to pick a number, why don't you go right in the middle? And that might be a safe place to start planning. But you have to pay for some of this as well because we're running enormous budget deficits, $36 trillion in total debt. We're adding $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion every single year. So we can't just, you know, pull a blind eye here and not address the deficit as well. So I do think we will get a reconciliation bill. And if I had to guess, it would be what – I forget her name that was on the panel earlier. I think it will be towards the end of the year because Congress doesn't move until they have to, and the threat of tax increases come January 1 will be enough to get people to move.
Always good to have incentive. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking all of our panelists. They did a great job. So as we wrap up here, I wanted to just a couple of closing comments. Want to especially thank everybody for hanging in there today. It's just been an incredible day of discussion, insights, perspectives, and once again, thank our sponsors for making this happen. Also, our staff, and I'd like all the AgriPulse staff to stand, if you would, because they've been working their tails off today. They've been making all the wheels turn while we've been up here back and forth. So in addition to the sponsors that made donations to make this happen, we are also very fortunate to have PepsiCo donate some of the food products and the International Fresh Produce Association, which also donated these lovely flower bouquets, both on the stage and on the table. So if you want to be really, really someone who can make your spouse or best friend happy, you're welcome to pick one of those up and take them home and give them to that person and make their day for St. Patty's Day. We'd welcome you to go ahead and do that. So take a centerpiece home. As you know, this has been something that we've been pulling together for about 9 years now on this large of a scale, and we really see this as the beginning of discussions every year, because we want to hear from you. We want you to make sure that you feel that you can contact us at any time, our editorial team, share your ideas, and keep these discussions going. As policies evolve and technologies advance, we think that maintaining that open dialogue remains crucial to foster productive dialogue and conversations and collaborations moving forward. So as you close out your day, we'd like you to make sure that we have welcomed you also to our next big event, which is our customer appreciation reception, which will be right next door in the Holman Lounge and all the rooms over there. We couldn't do this without everyone who has really helped us out and made it a special day, including all of you who've been in this room and shared it with us throughout the day. We have one more sponsor video, and that is from IFPA. So we'd like to go ahead and play that, and then I'd be happy to toast all of you for a very happy St. Patrick's Day. So please turn your eyes to the screen.